Before we all get feeling nostalgic about voting in some golden age, let's remind ourselves of something. The country's founders and its early leaders didn't want most Americans to vote at all. And for decades and decades, they made it difficult for those they saw as unworthy to cast a ballot. We wanted to talk about young voters today, where they fit in this story, and how they might compare to the young voters of another period in American history, because most of those 18 to 29 in this period of history choose not to vote. So we asked the historian John Grinspan to tell us the story of one young voter from another time. And he told us about one from the early 1800s. Now, this was a time, he says, when voting was, it was a thing, it was an event for a young voter, a young man. He said they got dressed up to cast their vote, and they never forgot that first time because Americans believed a vote had deep consequences for their lives and for the future of democracy.
Voting is really an initiation for young men in 19th century America. It's not drinking, it's not smoking, it's not these other things we think of today. The initiation into adulthood is casting your first vote at age 21. It's Western Nebraska, 1884. It's one of the most heated elections in American history. James G. Blaine, the Republican, Democrats hate him for being widely corrupt. And the Democratic candidate, Grover Cleveland, is very new and exciting, but it's been recently revealed that he had an affair and has a child out of wedlock. So this is one of the closest elections in U.S. history. It's decided by just around 1,000 voters. But it's a moment for young people in America where they can really make their voice heard. This first vote matters for lifetimes. And we have this young cowboy named J.J. McCarthy, living in Western Nebraska, born in Ireland, loves horses. Victor Hugo, the writer, and he's in a settlement outside of a major community, and he and the other cowboys are going to cast their first vote. But everything is kind of stacked up against him voting in this election. He's miles and miles from any polling place. They don't even have ballots. They don't have a judge. They don't have a ballot box. So they make up ballots, put them in a makeshift ballot box. JJ gets on his old buckskin horse, sets out as a pretty significant journey ahead of him. The Platte River is halfway frozen, halfway not. A nasty thing to ride a horse through, but these ballots are going to get cast. He battles his way through the water with his horse, makes it out the other side, rides several miles to the town, and delivers the ballots. And the people in town, even if they're not happy that he's adding 13 votes to the Democratic side, they take them and they add them to the list. And then town newspaper, they acknowledge the wet and bedraggled cowboy who came riding in with the ballots, but it's also a very partisan time and they make fun of him for casting ballots in the wrong way because they're a Republican paper. But for JJ and his fellow cowboys, it's his achievement. He later says he'll remember that first vote the way he remembers his first pair of trousers. And it says something about the role young people used to play in American democracy and how crucial that first vote could be for young Americans.
Young voters under 25 are taking to the streets and to social media to oppose President Trump. But will Generation Z's political energy translate into votes for former Vice President Joe Biden?
There are young people who are taking huge risks to vote in this election. There are people who are going to wait in lines during a pandemic, face down voter suppression. So there are young people who are really striving to make their voices heard. But there are also a lot of people who don't see it as central, kind of forget about it, don't see what it means, aren't really certain about its significance to themselves or the country, feel their vote doesn't matter.
Do you feel a little wistful about a time when people saw their vote, their first vote, as something that they would never forget? Do you feel wistful about the fact that that maybe isn't as prominent a feeling in modern day America as it was in that time?
So what I love about studying history is whenever you start to feel wistful or nostalgic, something hits you on the head and reminds you that this was not the golden age in any sense. JJ is going to incredible lengths to vote for the Democratic Party, which in 1884 is still really the party of white supremacy and voter suppression in much of the country. So I'm not saying JJ was a good guy or I'm glad his candidate won. I'm saying his engagement is really unique in the history of the world. Here's a government that is run by the engagement of young people. democracy is rare in all of world history, and youth engagement in democracy is even rarer. We should wonder how they did it, and if there's a way to bring back the good without bringing back the bad along with it.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about young voters today, the issues that matter to them, the way they're thinking about the election, and whether they'll show up and vote on November 3rd. But we're going to start with some history. John Grinspan doesn't want to romanticize this story, but he does study this stuff. And he says young voters in the early part of the country really did get out there and vote, even though the grown-ups, the guys who founded the country, older white property owners, really weren't keen on sharing the vote.
John Adams specifically argues against expanding the vote to more people and kind of jokingly says, what, are we going to let 12-year-olds vote?
Right.
And also, none of the founders believed in democracy as we see it today or as they saw it in the mid-1800s, that our sense of how the government should be run has really evolved in, I think, positive ways. But so they would have been unhappy with so many elements of the political system then or now that the founders, I almost don't think about them very much because they just weren't engaged. This idea of kind of one person, one vote and mass elections and political parties is just really foreign to their vision.
Yeah. And Noah Webster, you mentioned, wanted the voting age to be 45 or something.
Yeah, you know, he did. And throughout American history, there's a continuous line of people coming up with schemes to strengthen the vote for older people. The people have proposed you get another vote every 21 years. You know, there were all sorts of crazy ways to keep young people from engaging. And then once young people really do start to engage in the 1820s and 1830s, they do so really almost apologetically. They want to get engaged, but they care about the issues, but they kind of apologize for being young and having an opinion. And they're really bashful almost at first and get more confident as the century goes on.
But then you say something happens around this time where elections are transformed from this kind of ordinary, quiet affair to become this full-out spectacle. It becomes a party, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, some people call the 1840 election, which is really the kickoff for all of this, the hard cider election. The Whig Party, which is one of the two contending parties at that time, their candidate gets made fun of for being a kind of backwoods guy who lives in a log cabin and drinks hard cider. And they make hard cider the symbol of the people, the way you might with, like, Bud Light today. So beer, especially lager beer, becomes really connected with politics. And the saloon is often where you vote. The saloon is where political parties have headquarters. It's where young people meet politicians and get engaged. A lot of this happens over big, big glasses of lager.
You say they become elections become the centerpiece of this new American culture.
Yeah, I think we have to remember just how upended and disrupted life was for people back then. This is a diverse population. Many people have come from Europe and left or Africa and left behind old cultures, old traditions, their kind of folk ways, their holidays. And they're also, it's still at that time, a culture that's coming out of Puritanism and Calvinism and doesn't really have big, huge religious holidays. And so they need something to kind of fill the social void. And elections in November, especially presidential elections, but whenever an election comes along, and they have a lot of them back then, it's kind of a national popular culture. It's forged through arguing over the federal government because there isn't a shared religion, there isn't a shared ethnic or folk background or whatever. So the political parties and the political fighting kind of stands in as American identity. I think it's America's first pop culture, basically.
Hmm. And once young people become really engaged, you mention how, and I think this is worth underlining, in the 1820s, for example, you have maybe 25% voter turnout. But then young people start getting engaged. Americans start seeing this as a cultural thing. Over the next 50, 60 years, you say, you start seeing numbers in the 70, 80, even 90% turnout rate.
Yeah, just huge among eligible voters. But who's eligible is expanding. They open up voting to first white men without property, which sounds kind of minor to us, but it really opened up back then voting across class lines. And from there, there's movements to bring African-Americans into voting and women and just huge turnout. It's kind of assumed that everybody who can vote will vote. And someone who's seen as really excited goes above voting. Just voting is kind of the bare minimum for a lot of these people.
young Americans who decide to get engaged in all of this, talk a little bit more about how important that vote was, because you say Americans believed that a man, and we should emphasize it was men at the time, that a man's first vote had this deep consequence in their life, not only their life, but also the future of democracy. Say something about that.
Yeah, Americans back then believed not only that a man should cast his virgin vote, but after that, he should remain monogamous to his party, that a good, decent, manly man votes for the Democrats or the Republicans or the Whigs and votes, stays with that party for the rest of their life, that that first vote is a bond. And people who switch parties, independents, are seen as untrustworthy, are often seen as kind of effeminate and wishy-washy, and are mocked and derided. And it's seen as a sign of your adulthood and your trustworthiness and your masculinity if you stick with your party. So that sets up a political system where instead of trying to win over the other side with arguments, you just want to rally your base as much as possible because there just aren't that many voters who are going to switch sides.
What's in it for them? What's in it for young people who decide to vote?
I mean, what do young people ever want, I guess? But they want a sense of adulthood. They want a sense of identity. They want to change their government. They care about the issues. They want fun. They want to meet other people. Voting is just the central popular culture in America that can help them with all those things. They can meet employers if they need a job. They can meet adults in the country who will kind of put them forward and give them speaking opportunities and connect them with people. There's often flirtation and courtship is based around politics back then. So they can meet their future spouse or someone to court. They some do really care about the issues. Not everyone does, but some do. So maybe they hate slavery or love immigration or hate the banks or whatever issue is important back then. That does matter too.
Because the political was personal.
Yeah, absolutely. The political is personal and the personal is political. They're just so tied up back then. The idea that politics should be separate from the rest of life, that we've kind of inherited, this idea that you don't talk about politics at the dinner table, just doesn't exist. It's all just so tied up back then.
And all of this converges with what you describe as the wild years of American youth. And I wanted you to talk about this part because you mentioned in the book how people, like tourists who come from Europe, they're noticing the American young people, how kind of wild young people seemed, and how unlike in, you know, where they were from in Europe, American adults seem to be paying more attention to young people. What's going on here?
So we have this idea that back then it was kind of children should be seen and not heard. But America was notorious back then as the place where children were heard, that when Europeans came to America, they saw really one of the hallmarks of American democracy, which still seemed like a foreign idea to many people in the world. Young people were engaged, talked politics with their family members. Young people started working earlier because in America, there's so much land, there's so much opportunity, there's not much labor. There's not this huge kind of peasant underclass that they have in Europe. So a young person can get a good job at 12 and start going. And there are things like there's mass epidemics and these kinds of things that kill off a lot of children under 5 years old. So if you've made it to 10, if you've made it to 12, you're going to go out and behave like a grown-up. You're going to go get a job. You're going to go try to get something in this life. It's like a petri dish for people to get involved in politics.
You say democracy remade American child rearing.
Americans in this period, a lot of the parents express a huge deal of faith in their children to learn and figure it out and to be fairly tough. The idea that children are kind of precious and vulnerable and need to be shielded from everything, that kind of comes on later. As people start having fewer children, they kind of protect them more. But for much of the 19th century, the average age is something like 17 in America. It's the equivalent of, you know, Egypt or India today or Yemen. And there's just a lot of young people around and they're kind of knockabout. They don't all go to school. They get jobs. They work tough lives and they are engaged in what we consider adult activities like politics from a really young age. They get opportunities to engage much younger than we would consider reasonable today.
Where did young women fit? Because you said they found their own place in this democracy, even though they couldn't vote.
Yeah, we shouldn't believe, because young women were not allowed to vote, we shouldn't believe they sat on the sidelines and didn't care. That when you read the diaries and letters of young women in the 1800s, they argue about politics, they have strong beliefs, they debate things, they will court and hang out with men who have the politics that they agree with and kind of shun and ignore the men who don't. They use every element in their power at the time to influence politics and engage in politics. they just can't do that act of going and voting, which is hugely significant. And it's a big denial in their lives. But before they turn 21, when their peers, their male peers aren't voting anyway, they're especially engaged. And they turn out at events, they argue the issues, they read the newspapers. There's huge engagement among young women.
What was it like for a young man, again, those men in those days, to go out and vote for the first time? Because, and this was really interesting because you say that how a young man stepped out to vote said a lot about his values, his sense of style. Facial hair was important, it seems, to make that first vote.
Yeah, this is the golden age of beardedness, right? So yeah. Everybody who can grow a beard or a mustache or a goatee or something is growing one in October of an election year, because if you're 21 years old, you want to look like a man, you go grow your beard and they might let you vote. This is kind of one of those physical signs of this crossing this line into adulthood. On election day, young men would dress up, they'd wear a new hat, they'd fluff up their beard, they'd show up at the polls and hang around all day. They're kind of humorists and comedians who make fun of young voters in election day newspapers for being there, holding tickets, bragging about their first vote. It's so common, it's almost kind of mocked.
Let me ask you finally, are you seeing any connection to the moment we're in now, where you get a real sense that young people are engaging in the process in a way they haven't in a while? Are you seeing any comparison between this moment and that moment that you've been studying and writing, where young people really got involved in the American process of democracy through voting?
There are two harmful things for young people in politics. One is their parents keeping them from the issues and keeping them away from politics. But the other thing that's really harmful is this attitude that it doesn't matter, they're all the same, my engagement doesn't matter, this election isn't going to change anything. I think there are very few people of any age in America in 2020 who look at this election and say, this isn't going to change anything. But we know, because of the past 4 years, because of the pandemic, because of so many things, we know that politics matters in our lives. And I think there are many young people who see the immediacy and the urgency and the meaning in engaging today in a way that's much more similar to how people behaved in the 1800s than in the 1900s, when people didn't engage as much. A lot of young people for a long time kind of sat on the sidelines. I think a lot of young people today see the significance in their own lives really in a concrete way.
John Grinspan, thank you very much.
No, thanks for having me, Doug.
John Grinspan, he's with the Smithsonian National Museum of American History and the author of the book, The Virgin Vote. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So there's no doubt about it. Young people are passionate. They're more likely to go out and protest and sign petitions, create movements and social media. But for some reason, that activism doesn't always translate into an actual vote. Most young Americans, in fact, don't. They don't vote. But we wanted to know if any of that is changing, if this momentous election year may be different. Joining us now on the program is Dr. Quinn Monson. He's an associate professor of political science at Brigham Young University. These days, he's the newly appointed director of the Office of Civic Engagement Leadership there at the school. And Quinn Monson, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Glad to join you.
I guess I want to begin with that question that seems mystifying to a lot of people. Young people, as I said, they're engaged in issues. They go to protests. They create these movements on social media, but they don't always go out and vote. Do you think you understand that? Why is that?
Well, yeah, that's always been true, especially since we gave the vote to 18-year-olds and went from 21 to 18 on the voting age. What we see in young people is more instability in their lives, more mobility. And of course, when you vote in the United States, you have to register in all but North Dakota. And what that means is that you have to have an address. And if you're packing everything up into the back of your car and moving every 18 months or every 2 years or so, as college students do, and even many people into their 20s move frequently as they change apartments and roommates and jobs, that means you're changing addresses and you have to change and update your registration. And so even if you have good intentions and you want to participate, sometimes you're caught short because your registration isn't up to date. And in different places around the country, they have closing dates for registration changes before the election. Utah is a great place because we've updated our law and we allow same day registration. But I don't think that always is communicated to young people.
So wait, what you're saying is that it's circumstantial.
That's part of it. I think part of it is circumstantial. And I think part of it is also connected to the stage of life that young people are in the sense that when you are young, you might be motivated by politics in some ways to be upset at the national circumstances, but it may not be quite as motivating to vote as, say, a property tax increase when you're a homeowner, or the quality of the schools that your kids go to. If you don't have kids or you don't have a house and you don't pay property taxes, those things aren't nearly as motivating. And those kinds of things that come with stability and come with sort of the development of your life are also things that help motivate people to get involved in politics. And then I think finally, the last thing is that as you do get involved and you start to vote, you gain confidence and it becomes easier because you know how to go online and check your registration status and update it because you've done it before 6 or 8 times. And every time you've moved, when you've bothered to update it, you've figured that out and you know where your polling location is and you have the confidence to investigate your choices on the ballot and figure out what you're voting for. So just it's a matter of confidence and stability that comes with age.
But I wonder how this year might be different. Everyone thinks that, right? Like this growing movement about women's rights, the Black Lives Matter protests, this reckoning about systemic racism. Has that made this year different in any way? Would it in any way override some of those circumstantial issues, some of those realities that you talked about? Is there any sense of that?
Yeah, I think there's some sense that it will do something. It will affect things in some way. Now, will it completely erase the age differences that we see on voter turnout? Probably not. But will it make them smaller? Sure. And I guess the best evidence for that is to look at the difference in turnout between 2014 and 2018. And so one of the motivating factors among young people these days is the Trump presidency. And the fact that young people are much less likely to be enamored with Donald Trump than older people are. And in fact, maybe even more likely to be angry about it and motivated to participate. So if you look at turnout rates overall in 2018 compared to 2014, the gap between young and older turnout is much smaller in 2018. And it makes 2018 almost look like it's a presidential election, like it generated the interest and enthusiasm that a presidential election might generate. I would expect that will continue into this election even more so because it actually is a presidential election.
Right.
And so, you know, we will see higher youth turnout than we normally see even for a presidential year. And I would expect that we'll set turnout records among young people. But it won't. It still won't make up that gap.
Is Utah in any way different from the rest of the country when you think about young voters?
I would say, in terms of their participation, we're pretty typical. I think what the difference there could be that I think because we are a much more Republican state generally, that carries down into our younger voters. They're less Republican than their older voters, especially than their parents are. So maybe the same level of anger or enthusiasm that is motivated by the current president isn't quite the same as young people elsewhere in the country that lean further to the left. But it's still there.
Yeah.
And I think it will still make a difference.
Can I ask you, while you're on that point, this is something that you've talked about, is this idea of how young people become politically socialized early on. And traditionally, I guess that means that they get their politics, or at least their first inklings about their political dispositions, from their parents and their family. And so if their folks are Republican, or they hear a lot of, you know, Republican talking points at the dinner table or whatever, they might be more inclined to be Republican. Talk a little bit about that process and how it might be changing. And I guess the big question is, are young voters in Utah more likely to vote with their parents then?
Yeah, I think what political science tells us That is still generally true today, as much as it was when this was first written about decades ago, is that when we develop our ideas politically as kids, as young children, we inherit most of what we believe politically from our family and especially from our parents. And so what that means is that even as early as, 10 years old, 11 years old, kids have a party identification. They know that they are a Republican or a Democrat, or at least they can answer the question and they kind of understand what that means, but they don't really understand what that means. In other words, and I can tell you about this with a little story. When my son, who's now a young adult, was in fifth grade, he had a science project to do. And because I'm a social scientist and I was going to be the parent that helped him, I had him do a social science project about political socialization because he was kind of interested in politics and I was really interested in it. So I kind of nudged him to say, hey, Alex, let's investigate how kids your age learn about politics and develop partisanship. And it happened to be right in the middle of the fall of the 2012 election. And he was at an elementary school in Orem, Utah, which is about as Republican as it gets.
Right.
And especially in the midst of 2012, was, of course, very heavily in favor of the Republican nominee, Mitt Romney. And so we devised a little experiment where we made two versions of a little survey questionnaire. And on one version, it was asking the kids who they would vote for if they could vote for president between Mitt Romney, the Republican, and Barack Obama, the Democrat. And then later in the questionnaire, we asked the kids to say, are your parents Republicans or Democrats? You know, mom and dad, are they Republican or Democrat? And what was interesting to me is that all the kids knew what their parents were, their partisanship, and that it lined up, I think, 90% or more of the time. Okay, so on the version of the questionnaire that the kids got that had the names of the candidates in their party, they lined up perfectly. Another version of the questionnaire, I had Alex go and look at the two candidate websites, and I helped him write a little description of the two candidates based on just their issue positions that were different. So let's suppose you had to vote for president, and one candidate took these positions, and the other candidate took these other positions. And they were pretty typical partisan issue positions, and just, you know, a couple of sentences each. And we had the kids choose another random set of the kids got that version. For those kids, they all knew the partisanship of their parents as well, but they could not figure out who to vote for based on the issues. It was like they were flipping a coin. I think they split exactly 50-50, like 51-49, because they had no idea what the partisanship meant. So the kids that had the party label knew that they were Republican, but they had no idea why. And so kids, as they get older, they figure that out. By the time they're in high school, they have an inkling of as to why they're a Republican or why they're a Democrat, because they keep listening to mom and dad and others. But then that family influence is the biggest. The next biggest thing is the social context. And that has the power sometimes to push back on that family influence. And this is where I think we might see evidence of some change, because young people in particular, even in Utah, where they have been, you know, overwhelmingly raised as Republicans, are pushing back against some of that influence of their parents because they are rejecting some of the stuff they hear and see from the Trump presidency and from Donald Trump in particular. And I think there's a little bit of pushback there. So they're not swinging Democratic like you might see in other parts of the country as heavily, but they are becoming certainly less Republican, weaker in their Republican ties.
So you've said this, you've described them as homeless, feeling homeless party wise.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think they feel unmoored because they've been socialized strongly enough in their family and home setting to not want to be Democrats, but the context is pushing back against the strength of that Republican identification to the sense of they don't really know what to do. And so they're a little bit unmoored.
So do you see party affiliation, not now, but let's say in the not so distant future, changing? Like maybe young people are going to come of age thinking differently about partisan politics and about partisanship, traditional partisanship that is, you know, and thinking that party labels don't matter in the way they certainly seem to now.
It certainly leaves open the possibility that those party ties will be weaker into their middle and old age. There's a couple of moving parts here. One of them is the actions of the current National Republican Party. The other is the party at the state and local level. Yeah. And the Utah Republican Party hasn't gone down the road that the National Republican Party has, at least not to that same extent. And then the other big question mark is, what's the other major party doing? The National Democratic Party is inching to the left in the way that the Republicans have inched to the right. And the big question is, what does the Utah Democratic Party do? And I don't think there's a very good answer, because we don't see a lot of elected officials statewide from the Utah Democratic Party. We don't really know what that party looks like yet or much. So there's not a lot of party switching that would be likely to occur unless the Democratic Party became a very easy place to land. And I don't know that that's going to happen.
What are you seeing as the issues that really matter for young people right now? One of the things you've mentioned, I'll just sort of tee you off on this point anyway, is they don't feel that strongly about same-sex marriage, whereas once that was a real factor. Younger voters, you're saying, even Latter-day Saint young voters don't feel very strongly opposed, that is, to same-sex marriage.
Right, right. I mean, if you look back 15 years ago, that was a big deal. Or even 10 years ago, right? It was a big deal. And it's just not anymore. The Supreme Court has taken that off the table. And because attitudes have changed so dramatically in the public nationally, and even in Utah, and even among Latter-day Saints, to be more accepting, then it means that politicians aren't talking about it and aren't really proposing anything. So those kind of social issues, I don't think motivate young people. A different set of social issues, I think, does motivate them. I think issues surrounding race and fairness and other things, and then at the are motivating and important, even in Utah, and even among young, otherwise relatively conservative sort of Republican young people and Latter-day Saint young people. I think they are motivated by those things to a greater extent than their parents were. I don't want to overstate it here, but then the other thing that probably motivating that is an important local issue is, and I don't know how to describe it exactly or articulate it, but I think it has to do with financial instability and housing instability and sort of issues related to, can I make enough money to buy a house?
College loan debt.
Things related to that. Our housing costs in the state have skyrocketed and, it's harder. It's much harder to buy a house in your 20s than it used to be for people. So I think that's likely to be a big deal, and something that political leaders that want to address and appeal to younger voters should figure out how to talk about and what to do.
Okay, Quinn Monson, final question. Let me ask you this, and this is the question: will they turn out? That is, will this be a story when we talk on Wednesday morning, or more likely the days after all of this is settled, maybe even months after all of this is settled? Will we talk about the fact that young people didn't just talk a good game this time; they actually showed up? What do you think? What's your hunch?
I think it depends on your expectations. If you expect them to match their 50-something-year-old voters in their turnout rates, you're going to be disappointed. If your expectations are driven by, what they did in 2020 or 2016 or 2012, then you're likely to be pleasantly surprised that their turnout rate will go up significantly. And it will likely contribute, I think, to what is likely to be record-setting turnout in Utah and nationally.
It's Quinn Monson. He's an associate professor of political science at Brigham Young University and the newly appointed director of the Office of Civic Engagement Leadership at the school. Quinn, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about young voters, and I have to say mostly behind their backs. So let's talk to some actual young people who are thinking about these things. First off, we have with us a former colleague of ours, Ale Vallarta, is with us. Used to work with us here. These days, she's the development director for the Rural Utah Project. And Ale, thanks for doing this. Welcome.
Thanks, Doug. It's good to be here.
Also with us is Samuel Benson, who's studying sociology at Brigham Young University. He's also an editorial assistant and opinion writer for the Deseret News. You can find a link to a column he wrote about young voters on our website. We'll give you details about that a little bit later. Samuel Benson, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
No, thank you, Doug. Happy to be here.
Okay, so I guess I wanted to begin with the conversations you guys are having with your friends right now. Like, how? Just think about like the last week or so, or maybe the last few months. How much of that has been about this political moment, this social justice moment, and how much of it is just kind of the chit chat? Like, how much of this, the tumult of this moment, is dominating the conversation right now? Ale, you start.
Honestly, Doug, all of it.
Yeah.
yeah. And I am a self-described elder millennial, right? So I'm nearing sort of 30. My cohort tends to be a little bit older. The decisions that are made very much affect our lives. And it's frustrating sometimes the extent to which we're viewed as a cohort that's not affected by the decisions that are made in leadership and at the higher level. I don't know if you're planning on getting more into those issues specifically, but I can tell you, I mean, across the gamut, yeah, 100%, we're concerned. Some of us are frustrated that it's dominating the conversation, and some of us are, I would go so far as to say, frightened by the potential outcome.
Yeah, we'll get to the issues here in a moment here. I do want to know. Sammy, what about you? What are the conversations you're having?
No, I'd have to agree, very similar. I think the most overarching theme amongst my friends and my associates is just the idea of divisiveness, of polarization. As young people, there are issues that are very serious to us, whether they be social issues or economical issues or whatnot. But the biggest thing is that there's just so much divisiveness in the country right now, and both sides are so polarized. For me and a lot of my friends, it's hard for us to fit the mold of either Trump or the left. You know, there's so much middle ground that we feel isn't being covered right now. And so I'd say that's the biggest thing, at least in my conversations with some of my associates.
One of the questions we're trying to get at during this program is why it is that most young people in this country just don't vote. And we had this conversation with Quinn Monson a moment ago, who talks about that it's circumstantial, it's stability. They don't have addresses in the same way. But Ale, what do you make of it? Have you sort of puzzled out that question of why it is most young Americans don't actually go out and vote?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's apathy, which has for a long time been regarded as the reason.
Yeah.
I think it's that voting's too complicated. I mean, I work for a voting organization and I get questions every day that I have to turn to, you know, vote.utah.gov or turn to someone else in the community to get answers to. Even in Utah, where we have an all mail-in ballot, which is perceived to be very effective and very simple, we know that in rural communities, there aren't a lot of drop boxes. The distance between post offices and county seats can be far. Today is the voter registration deadline in Utah, but actually you can register to vote day of in person and get a provisional ballot. It's complicated. The online system requires a Utah driver's license. A lot of young people that are new to the state maybe haven't updated their license yet and therefore think they're ineligible to vote. And it's not a good system. So I think ultimately, I mean, we need more civics education in schools. 14% of the young electorate is in rural areas. And there needs to be a sort of a pipeline for civic leadership. I think also, I believe that we should be pre-registering people to vote when they're 16 and they get a driver's license.
Samuel Benson, what about you?
I agree with what Ale said and what I'm sure what Dr. Monson said about the logistics and the nuances of voting. But I'd say beyond that, some of the narrative surely doesn't help. A lot of people are saying that this is the most important election in the history of the United States. It's a battle for the heart and soul of our country, things like that. And when you have 15 million young voters who are voting for the first time, who weren't eligible to vote in 2016, they were too young, that's a lot of pressure to tell a young person, don't mess up, don't blow it, this our country's at stake. And that might prevent some from getting to the polls, just shying away and saying, hey, I don't want that type of pressure on my shoulders.
I wonder, what are the relationships or factors that are influencing or that influenced your political views? Because one of the things we were talking about with Quinn Monson was that family, you know, your folks, their political ideas is a big influencing factor. But I'm wondering if that's changing. Ale, what do you think? Did you get your views at least initially from your folks, or does that come from somewhere else now?
I mean, I think part of it is shaped by being, of course, a person of color. I mean, my upbringing and my experience was different in many ways. I grew up in Florida, which is a very interesting state. And certainly views around like climate change, the environment, environmental justice, those were issues. Every year we got hammered by hurricanes. I started to think about the relationship between leadership and the climate. My mom is a single mom, working mom. She raised me by herself. So I watched her battle broken infrastructure and a system that certainly favored families that looked different than ours. And so, yeah, a lot of my views were shaped by that experience. My parents aren't deeply political people. They just, you know, wouldn't debate political issues at night and things like that. But when I went to college, certainly I was surrounded by people of more political mind, and I started to thread the needle with, oh, these feelings that I have about these issues, they actually relate to a political system that I am free to participate in.
Yeah. Samuel, what about you? Did you feel tethered to your folks' political ideas for a time and then you sort of went off on your own, or how did it work for you?
I think there's certainly a foundation that's laid in the home with your parents or with your parent, depending on the situation. I grew up in a conservative home. I still consider myself to be a moderate conservative. I view myself as a never Trumper. And I'd say that there's a large swath of people my age that are in that group. Only 11% of 18 to 29 year olds consider themselves to be Trump supporters. And so it's less than 50% of the conservatives. So I think especially in an age where you have information that's so readily available online or on the internet, it's easy to study and to learn and to figure out who you are and what you identify as politically, at least. And so I say, yeah, for a time, there's definitely a foundation that's laid in the home. But whether it be in college or at other times, you have to figure things out for yourself. You have to figure out what you believe, what you stand for. I mean, in an age where information is all around, it's pretty easy to do that.
There was this question that was put. Samuel, you've written about this, and a lot of people will remember it. It was a graduate student at a town hall with Joe Biden. And the question went like this. If you win in November, there will be a 56-year gap between you and myself. How can someone like you represent my generation? So, Allie, to that point, like, how can you relate to someone like Joe Biden or Donald Trump or any of these older white men who don't have the same kinds of experiences, the same kind of, you know, coming of age experiences that you do? Like, how are young people thinking about these candidates with such a gap there?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we live in a very much, I think, a gerontocracy. I'd like to see that change. There's a couple things we can do to change that. Term limits would be a good start. But I think there are two ways that people who are older can earn sort of the loyalty and the respect of young voters. And one is by respecting our young leaders. We're constantly encouraged to rise to leadership positions, to take on issues, to talk about them, to bring ideas. But when young people do, they get absolutely slaughtered in the press and by older people. I think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is the perfect example. Yeah. She has been called insolent, arrogant, fanciful. I mean, she's a young woman with some new ideas, right? So we've seen a loyalty to older people that respect our young leaders and welcome them into leadership. The second thing I think is on issues. I mean, if we learned anything this year, it's that young people actually don't care if you're cool. I mean, the loyalty to Bernie, the love for Elizabeth Warren, most recently, the Markey Kennedy race in Massachusetts. Yeah. I mean, Ed Markey came around on the issue of climate change. And what young people said was, if you show up for the issues that we care about and you speak to us and you do the work, we will be loyal to you. And Kennedy, by all accounts, is like, should be very appealing to young people. He's handsome. He's interesting. He's, you know, sort of fabulous. Mm. And they said, no thanks. Yeah. Young, they said, no, thank you. You know, we are here for the person that did the work and we're not going to let them down. And that's what happened.
Sammy, you've written about how it would be a mistake to assume voters or the votes of young people for anyone, Joe Biden in particular, are necessarily a stamp of approval for either candidate or either party. Say more about that.
Yeah. So I think especially with young voters, and when I say young voters, I'm usually referring to that 18 to 30 range, more or less. So younger millennials that are Gen Z, even those that support President Trump or Vice President Biden in this year's election, over 50% of both aren't enthusiastic with their votes. And so people are supporting both sides. And Biden does have a 20 percentage point margin right now with young voters. but people aren't necessarily excited about him or about the potential candidates. I think part of that just goes to points back to a general level of mistrust for political leaders, for institutions in general. But I think it's also what Ali was saying, is that people care less about who the individual is and more about their policy positions. A lot of young liberals would have liked to see Bernie or Elizabeth Warren a more radical candidate. A lot of young conservatives don't like Trump, quite simply. And so it's about policy. You think someone like President Trump, who's obscenely vocal, who's on Twitter, who's accessing young people like that, would be liked, and he's not, for a number of reasons that we don't have to dive into. But yeah, like Ali said, I think it goes back to less of who these individuals are, how old they are, and more about what they stand for and what they're saying.
Top issue, Ali, for you or and the people you talk with.
Oh, I mean, that's a tough one. I think there's sort of two layers to the top issue. There is, I would say there's the top issue layer that's the urgent, like saving of the situation issues, like saving the ACA, saving our democracy, climate change. And then I think there's the top issue that's more of a forecast, like things I'd like to see long term and my cohort would like to see long term. And that's, you know, for me tends to be, I have a more progressive view on those issues. But the biggest thing is reimagining our economy and the way we understand work. We have an active gig economy now, a green economy, a creative economy, and our idea about a workday, wages, and how that all knits together feels so antiquated to the way that young people work today. And I think we need to radically reimagine our system to meet that need.
Sammy, what about you and the conversations that you're having? Like, what are the top things that you're thinking about? I mean, because these seem to not be entirely the obvious ones, the partisan issues that are playing out right now. It's, as Ali was talking about, like much deeper thinking about reforming these tired systems in some ways. Does that reflect what you're hearing among your friends as well?
Yeah, I think so to an extent. I'd honestly say the biggest issue for a lot of people I've spoken to isn't necessarily a policy issue. It's just restoring dignity and respect for life to the office of the president. Having someone who's respectful, who we believe stands for American values, someone who can unite our country. And I think below that, a big policy issue, at least in my eyes, is immigration. After our last recession in 2008, 2009, it led to huge increases of border security, border control, led to increases in deportations and whatnot. If we want to get out of this economic rut we're in, we need immigrant workers. We need high-skilled workers. And we've seen over the last 4 years a huge gap between the lives of what immigrants can be in our country and what they are. We've seen xenophobia. We've seen racism. And I think a huge part of healing our country, not just from the COVID-19 pandemic, but from the last 4 years of a harmful presidency is giving value to our foreign-born immigrants.
Let me ask you finally, do you guys think you're going to show up, your cohorts? I know you'll show up, but I mean, what do you think, Ali?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This moment, there is, and something that we haven't really talked about that I feel like is one of the biggest things influencing young people participating in this election is the coronavirus pandemic. Yeah. And this election is very much a referendum on that. And specific to Utah, I know that when I talk to other young people, they're upset. They're angry. And they feel that, at least people in my cohort, in some sense, conversations about civility feel like a bit of a ploy to temper public outrage about the way the virus has been handled. And I think that, you know, accountability is really important, especially in this state, because we do have a dominant one-party rule. And so showing up to make sure that people know that, you know, we're watching, we're paying attention, and we care deeply about our neighbors and the sanctity of their life is a huge driving force in Utah.
Sammy Benson, are you optimistic for voter turnout for young people?
I agree. I mean, if not this year, then when? It seems like every 4 years, the pundits and the analysts say that voters or young voters could sway the election, and then they never show up. I think if young voters are going to turn out any year, it's going to be this year. We're now in month 8 of a pandemic that's exacerbated inequalities in healthcare. It's helped us realize some of the rampant racism and inequalities in our social structures. And the most concrete call to action that young people can take is to vote, especially in a democracy like ours. We talk about standing for issues or standing for truth. And the best way to make that stance concrete is to go to a ballot and vote, or vote by mail. And so I think if voters are ever going to turn out, this is going to be the year, and I have confidence that we're going to.
Samuel Benson, he studies sociology at Brigham Young University. He's an editorial assistant and opinion writer for the Deseret News. We have a link to his column that he wrote about young voters on our website, radiowest.org. Samuel, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And Allie Vallarta, a good friend of ours, development director for the Rural Utah Project. Allie, thank you very much.
You're so welcome.
Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. As always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Ivana Martinez, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.